This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income. We're going to cover a topic I think is becoming more important and critical to anyone planning for retirement, whether you're planning for retirement, currently retired, maybe you're working and trying to save up for, I don't know, a college education. Maybe you're an endowment. Maybe you're a foundation that has to make 5% distributions. What we're talking about are the lowest interest rates that we've seen going back to, you would have to go back to World War II. And it's no secret that central banks around the globe are going to keep interest rates that way as long as economies remain weak. Just in the last couple of weeks, we've seen the ECB cut interest rates, the Central Bank of Australia, followed by the Central Bank of South Korea. So with weak economies, central banks have made the message loud and clear. Interest rates for the foreseeable future are here to stay. So today we're going to talk about, if you're one of those individuals that have been sitting on the sidelines in cash, when do you make the move? And if you do make a move, where do you put your money to not only earn a decent return, but also a return that allows you to sleep at night, something that you're going to be comfortable with? It doesn't do you any good if you're going to invest in a market or an investment where it keeps you up at night because you're worried about the rate of return. And we'll be addressing that issue as well.
And I'm Kathleen Harris, and coming up later on the program, Jim will be talking with Peter Bell, the president and CEO of the National Reverse Mortgage Lenders Association, about the use of reverse mortgages in funding different types of retirement situations. Jim, as we're thinking about people who've been sitting on the sidelines, a lot of them have been on the sidelines since 07, 08, 09, 10. I was just thinking about some of the things you covered on your weekend show this past weekend. You talked a little bit about time is running out for income investors. In other words, if you're waiting for a time to get in to make income, you know, the clock is ticking on you. You got to start making decisions soon. And the other thing you talked about was about this whole idea about dividend payers. I know I get a lot of questions from potential clients asking me, you know, is this dividend paying story? I mean, everyone's talking about it. Isn't it overinvested at this point? Is it really still the best place to be? And I know you addressed it on the weekend show about, is there still room for the dividend paying investment to grow? And the answer is yes. But you discussed also, you need to make sure that you know what you're buying when you buy a dividend payer.
Yeah, I mean, there were a series of stories that we covered on the weekend show, Kathleen. They had to do with what's happening in the fixed income market. There have been a number of financial newspapers, from the Financial Times out of London to the Wall Street Journal to Reuters, talking about what's going on in the bond market. And I'm just going to read a couple headlines. These are headlines that were just from one newspaper, the Financial Times. And here are the headlines. The hunt for yield brings return of risky lending practices. Boy, when I saw that and read the article, does that harken back to what investors were doing, buying CDOs, collateralized mortgage obligations, and these mortgage pools in the last credit crisis. So that was one headline. The next headline, yield hunters spark junk bonds frenzy. We're seeing the lowest yield in 30 years in the junk bond market since we've been recording them. Another one, the scarcity of value in emerging market bonds drive prices higher. So as the yields drop in places like Asia, Japan, Australia, South Korea, in places like that, what investors are doing, believe it or not, they're going to places like Rwanda to get yields. And then finally, U.S. junk debt yields hit historic lows, and Reuters, U.S. junk bond yields, they call it the yield to worst, drops below 5%. And what they were doing here, Kathleen, they were talking about the yields have dropped so precipitously over the last 6 months as QE has gone global. Investors have gone to the riskiest areas to get a decent return. In other words, investors are trying to get 5 and 6%.
Jim, where are investors putting their money in these bond markets to get those kinds of yields?
Well, Kathleen, they're putting their money in places I would, well, personally, I wouldn't be sleeping at night if I was putting my money in this area. I mean, they're going to, for example, CCC rated bonds. That is basically from a bond rating only about one step above default. And you would think, why would you do that? Well, the reason they're doing it is on a C or triple C rated bond, you can get a yield of close to 6%. But as S&P gave triple C rating bonds have a 50% or higher chance of defaulting over the next 12 to 18 months. So what good would it be to earn 5% or 6% if the probability of default is greater than 50%? That's coming from S&P. Moody's saying likewise. But despite all that, Kathleen, that's where investors are really going after, because everybody wants to say, you know, if let's say you had a pension plan and you had $100,000 in it. Well, a 5% yield, you're getting $5,000. If you wanted to put that in two-year treasury bonds, you would get $225. So you can see why investors are reaching out on yield, because they're trying to keep themselves even with inflation, or they're trying to earn enough interest. They may be retired where they can actually pay their bills, and it's getting harder and harder. And that's why our piece on the weekend is that time is running out for fixed income investors to avoid being impoverished.
Well, Jim, over the past, 6 months to a year, what we've seen happen with yields is, because QEs just keeps happening worldwide, what we've seen is that a lot of different types of debt can be issued at lower and lower interest rates, and people are so desperate for income, they'll still snap up those bonds. So when you and I first started talking about fixed income, 6 months ago, 9 months ago, you could still get fairly reasonably rated debt that was paying you 4% and 5%. You really can't get that anymore. Even right now, to get a triple B rated bond, you're looking at a maximum yield of around 2.5% to 3%. That's a significant drop in income stream for someone who's trying to invest in fixed income now versus when you and I first started talking about bonds 6 months ago. I mean, that's a significant drop in interest rates.
Yeah, I want to do a couple things, Kathleen. I want to share with our listeners just how dramatic this has become just in the last 12 months. Now, everybody, if we hearken back to last year, everybody was worried about Europe. Was Europe going to break up? Was Greece going to leave the euro? And then, of course, this year we had the problems with Cyprus, where investors and Cyprus banks took a hit if they had over $100,000. But just to give you an idea, as a result of all this money printing and all this QE, this will give you an example of what has happened to bond yields. Greek bond yields have gone from 29% down to as low as 9.3% in the last 12 months. If I go to another pig country like Portugal, Portugal had bond yields a little over a year ago of 12%. Today, Portuguese bond yields are the lowest that they've been in the last 12 months at 5.3%. If we want to go to Spain, Spanish bond yields have gone from 7.5% down to 4%. And everybody remembers Italy. Italian bond yields have gone from 6.5% down to 3.75%. So even in those areas of the world that we knew had tremendous problems with balancing their books, their budgets, etc., those bond yields have actually dropped to the lowest levels that we've seen probably in the last 2 or 3 years if we look at the pig countries. But it doesn't stop there. And what I'd like to do is, when you're investing in bonds, and let's just say you're a U.S. investor, that you can invest in treasuries. If you're in a high tax bracket, you could buy muni bonds, or you can buy corporate bonds. And what I'd like to do is just share with our listeners what those yields are, and beginning with the treasury market. If you were to buy a 3-month T-bill, you would get 0.04%. If you were to invest in a 6-month treasury bill, you would get less than 0.1%. If you were to invest in a 2-year treasury note, you would get 0.2%, a 10-year treasury note 1.8%, and a 30-year treasury bond 3%. In the municipal bond market, 10-year yields on a AAA-rated general obligation bond is around 1.9%. However, if you were willing to go to triple B rated municipals. And let me explain. Investment grade bonds are triple A to triple B. Anything below a triple B rated bond is considered a junk bond. But if we went and took a look at triple B rated municipal bonds, that's, you know, you're talking about a city that has a good possibility of going into default like Stockton. The yield on triple B is only 3.49%. If you went with corporate bonds, we have seen a big drop in corporate bonds. A triple B rated corporate bond on 10 years, you're going to have to go out 10 years. You would only get 3.39%. Let's call it 3.4%. I can get a better yield in a utility stock. Now, let's start going into what we call the lower quality bonds. So if I went to triple B bonds, this will give you an idea what you're going to get. Let's say you wanted to go into corporate bonds and you said, okay, I don't want to go out long term because I'm worried about interest rates rising. A 5-year triple B rated bond only pays a little over 2%. Think about that. A 5-year bond, triple B rated, only one step above a junk bond, pays a little over 2%. If you wanted something decent, if you wanted to get something close to 5%, which is the all these articles that have come out recently where investors are chasing, let's say, lower quality credits, you would have to go out 30 years. And Kathleen, even then, you're only going to get 4.5%. Now, it gets even worse. Let's assume that you're saying, you know what, I'm willing to roll the dice. I think the economy is going to improve. I'm going to go into, well, I'll go into a junk bond, but I'm going to go into the highest rated junk bond I can get, which is a double B rated bond. A 5-year junk bond, double B, pays less than 3%, and a 10-year junk bond only pays 4.5%. And that was the articles that were coming out this week, Kathleen, is that for the first time in 30 years of recorded history on, let's say, the Barclays High Yield Index, which we've been tracking for 30 years, this is the lowest yield in its 30-year history. It got down to below 5% this week at 4.97.
When we're thinking about comparing where we're at now to a year ago, Jim, I think I have an example of some clients I talked to for the first time a year ago and the solutions I presented to them then versus what's available to them now. So if you don't mind, I'd like to talk a little bit about a couple we're going to call Mr. and Mrs. David and Michelle Stash, as in cash stash, as in they have been in cash for a long time. So David and Michelle are retired. David's now 71. Michelle is 66. David was a dentist. Michelle, his wife, was his dental hygienist. We see this happen a lot with small family businesses. Right now in their retirement, their budget is about $80,000 a year. This is their story, Jim. They have been investing faithfully in their own self-employed retirement plans, you know, every single year. And they got up to $1 million in savings right before the 2000 crash. 2000 crash happened, and like everybody else, they took a big haircut on their retirement savings. But they talked about it as a couple and decided, okay, we're still several years away from retirement. We're just going to wait this thing out, stay invested, and see what happens. So by the fall of 07, their portfolio was back up to $1.4 million. David retired in late 07, and things were looking pretty good. Then all of a sudden, we had that horrible crash happen in the fall of 08. Michelle and David, again, sat down as a couple and said, what are we going to do this time? We don't have any more time to wait before we retire. We are retired. We can't afford to wait for our investments to recover. So they decided in November of 08, they were going to go to cash. Wasn't quite at the bottom of the market, but it was close. And they have been sitting in cash ever since. They constantly talk about, when should we go back in? What should we buy? What should we do? Should we do bonds? Should we do CDs? Should we do metals? Should we do stocks? And they've just been spinning their wheels ever since the fall of 08. They just don't know what to do. Now, the first time I talked to him, Jim, was about a year ago. And as we just discussed, yields were very different a year ago. So the last time I talked to them, we talked about a blended bond and stock portfolio. And they discussed as a couple, and they decided, you know what? They just didn't have the stomach for any of the risk, whether it was interest rate risk with the bonds or market risk with the stocks. They just couldn't do it. So, you know, they said, well, thank you very much for your help, Kathleen. We're just going to have to think about this some more. So about 6 months later, they called me. This was November, right after the elections. And we talked again. And they said, well, Kathleen, we're just really worried about the fiscal cliff. We're really worried the market's going to take a tumble. We're just worried about the economy rolling over with all this, you know, high taxation coming forward. So, you know what, Kathleen, we're just not really ready to make a move quite yet. And so once again, they had an opportunity to invest after we did have a market drop in the fall of last year, as people were sort of rolling out of stocks, just waiting for that fiscal cliff disaster to happen. But if you were someone who was waiting for a good time to pick up stocks, it was a great time to be investing for the first time. Good time to be picking up some stocks at some good valuations. So again, as we've talked about on the show before, 2013 rolls around, fiscal cliff proves out to be more of a fiscal bump. Not a whole lot happens. I get another call from David and Michelle. And they say to me, okay, Kathleen, this is a situation. We've just realized David has to start taking his minimum required distributions from his IRA. And where we're at right now, that's all going to have to come out of cash. We have to do something. And so we talked and came up with a strategy as far as what they should do with their assets. But the hard thing was, Jim, talking with them in early 2012 was much, much different than talking to them in, you know, when I first started talking with them almost a year earlier. Just things had changed so much. They've been on the sidelines for so long, they've been missing out on all these opportunities to invest.
I think the critical part here is, and when you turn 71 and a half, if you're not familiar and you have, let's say, a 401k program, and when you retire, you roll it over into something called an IRA rollover, you can allow it to compound. But at age 70 and a half, the government requires you to take a minimum distribution. And what happened here with the, we'll call them the stashes, is David had to take a distribution, and his RMD, his required minimum distribution, was $30,000. Well, when you're making 0% on your interest, it's not quite zero, because they had some money at a bank that was earning a small rate of return, but they were basically going to have to start taking it out of principal. And also, that $30,000 distribution would happen every single year. And so they were very concerned about that. And so what I'm going to do, Kathleen, is just kind of give our listeners a little bit of a background of color in terms of their assets. Okay, they had a home in Escondido that was valued close to about $600,000. Now, the good news there for the stashes is that house was paid for. So there were no mortgage payments. The only expenses were the utilities, you know, the house insurance and the property taxes. David's IRA was worth about $800,000. Now, remember, in 2007, this account was worth about $1.4 million between the two of them, because also his wife had Michelle's IRA is worth about $200,000. The long story short is that $1.4 million dropped to $1 million when they got out of the market in November of 2008. And unlike 2000, when they were working, they basically said, you know, we can ride this out. We still have income coming in from their business in dentistry, so they could afford to ride it out because they had another means of income. What was different for this couple in 2008 is they were no longer working, so they were totally dependent on their Social Security and whatever they could get off their investments. And what they were doing was drawing down on those investments and also drawing down on their bank balances that they kept at the bank in order to support their living. Now, their income budget was fairly modest for a California couple, but let's get into their assets. Okay, I mentioned they had a $600,000 home in Escondido that was full paid for, so at least they didn't have to have any mortgage payments. David's IRA was down to about $800,000, and his required minimum distribution would be $30,000, and that number would go up every single year. So the longer that David lives, the bigger that number is going to be. Now, Michelle's IRA was worth roughly about $200,000, and they had roughly about $200,000 at the bank that used to be much bigger. Basically, what they've been drawing down to support their living needs over the last couple of years has been drawing down their bank balances. So their net worth was about $1.8 million, of which $1.2 million included their IRAs, cash at the bank, and the other $600,000 made up their home. So they had a good amount of assets. And one would think, you know, anybody listening to this, I can remember doing retirement planning in the 80s. I can remember one of my first clients was a doctor, and I remember him telling me distinctively in 1985. He goes, Jim, when I retire, He goes, I'd like to have $1 million saved up in my pension plan. Now, you remember, in 1985, I could have put you in a government Ginnie Mae bond and made you anywhere from 13 to 14%. I could have put you in a utility stock and I could have made 12%. So $1 million back in 1985 would have produced about $130,000 to $140,000 worth of income, which is what my client, the doctor, was making at that time. So it was not unreasonable to think, hey, if I can get $1 million at today's interest rates, I'm going to make exactly what I'm making as a salary as a doctor. I'm home free. This is going to be great. Who would have ever thought that $1 million today invested in a treasury note would only produce $2,200 of income? I can remember 5 years ago, if I would have invested in a two-year treasury note, $1 million would have produced $50,000 worth of income, not $2,200. So you can see how dramatically things have changed. And it was one of the reasons why on the weekend show, Kathleen, I wanted to cover that time is running out for income investors, because as more and more central banks proceed with quantitative easing, in just the last 2 weeks alone, we've seen the ECB, Australia, and South Korea cut interest rates. So they're still in the interest rate cutting mode. And if you read the minutes of the FOMC meeting, they're saying, hey, if this economy weakens, we could actually accelerate quantitative easing. So low interest rates are here. They're here to stay for quite some time as central banks try to stimulate their economies and drive down the interest costs for their respective governments, as all of these governments are going heavily into debt, whether it's the United States, whether it's Europe or Japan. So interest rates are going to remain low. But unfortunately, a lot of these opportunities, as you talked about the stashes a year ago, I could have got them a lot more return in fixed income investments. But those returns, Kathleen, are drying up. Unless you want to venture into the junk bond market, and I sure would not recommend that to anybody, because I think you are simply asking for trouble when you are buying a CCC rated bond that has a 60% chance or greater of defaulting in the next 12 months.
So, Jim, when I first talked with the stashes a year ago, as I mentioned briefly, my solution for them to generate them income was to do a blend of some fixed income, some bonds, some good quality bonds, and some dividend paying stocks. And like we mentioned at that time, although fixed income yields weren't great, they were much better than they are today. But they weren't ready to pull the trigger then, weren't ready to pull the trigger later in November. It wasn't until early this year that they finally decided, okay, we have to do something different. And so the bottom line with this couple, Jim, is that they've been in cash for such a long time, almost 6 years in cash. When you've been in cash for such a long, long time, it is really hard to get back in the market. It's really hard to motivate. It's hard to know how much to put in. It's hard to know how much risk to take, because you've been scared for 6 years. So it's really hard to make that choice. So what I sat down with the stashes and discussed with them was, okay, let's not throw everything in the market all at once. You're clearly not going to be comfortable with that. So let's sit down and figure out, of your $1.2 million in liquid assets, how much are you comfortable putting in the market? What percentage can you put in the market and still be able to sleep at night? So we talked about, well, okay, let's say that we put all $1.2 million in some dividend-paying stocks in the market, because, again, fixed income I just feel wasn't appropriate right now, because, like you were saying, Jim, the risks to fixed income right now are pretty high. So I really felt like, for them, dividend-paying stocks were a better way to go. So I said to them, if you put all $1.2 million into a dividend-paying strategy and you net 2.5% from that dividend-paying strategy, that's $30,000. That would essentially cover David's required minimum distribution for the year. So if you invest the whole shebang in the market, you can pretty much cover David's required minimum distribution for this year. Well, what about if you just put 75%? Put 75% in that same type of dividend paying strategy, you'll make $22,500. Won't really, get you David's full required minimum distribution, but it'll cover most of it. But even that was a little bit too risky for them, Jim. So we went over, what if they put 50% in, which would get them $15,000? Or if they put 25% in, which would get them $7,500. We talked about it. They talked about it. They thought about it. They talked about it some more. at the end of the day, Jim, they decided that they were going to go ahead and put half of their money into dividend-paying strategies, which would give them that $15,000 a year in income. But they were just not ready to put the whole thing in. So they kept the other 50% in money market and laddered CDs. And although it's not a perfect solution in terms of generating income for them, it was the solution that felt comfortable for them. And I think sometimes, Jim, when you have someone who's been in cash for a long time, you know, there's sort of this idea that they should put everything in the market, that they need to start making a full-blown investment strategy with all their assets. But the reality is, not everyone's ready to do that. But the bottom line is, if you're not willing to put 100% of your assets in the market, maybe you put 10%, maybe you put 25%, maybe you put 50%. You pick a number, you pick a percentage you're comfortable with, and make a plan with it so that at least a portion of your money is doing some work for you instead of just sitting in a bank earning next to zero.
And it's not just that, Kathleen, in this case where we end up putting half in dividend-paying stocks. I'm still working on trying to convince them that putting a laddered bond portfolio in higher quality credits, that getting 3% to maybe 4% at the most in a laddered bond portfolio for at least 25% of their portfolio certainly beats making a quarter of a percent or a half a percent on their CDs. So when you can make six to maybe eight times the amount in the laddered bond portfolio, and there are going to be times, as I'm sure you've explained, and I can remember being in one of the meetings saying, hey, look, I can put you in a Coca-Cola. Your dividends are going to go up. They have a history. They've been paying dividends since the Great Depression. But I'm not going to sit there and tell you that you're not going to wake up one day and the stock market's not going to correct and be down 10%. But the thing I tried to show them was a history of the dividends, and that even though the stock went down in the correction like we got in, for example, the fall in 2011, the dividend didn't change. The dividend remained the same, and the dividend has been going up each year. And so the next part that we're trying to work here is basically saying, look, it makes sense to take at least maybe 25-30%, put into, let's say, a laddered portfolio 5 to 10 years, but making 3 and 4% sure in the heck beats making 0.25% to 0.5%. We're not there yet, just like they weren't there and they weren't ready to go into stocks a year ago.
I think this is a really important point to make, Jim, because especially when you're talking about someone who's looking at their portfolio as the primary, if not the only source of their income flow, you really have to strategize pretty specifically about what that money is doing for you. In fact, Jim, I think this really relates well to what you'll be talking about with Peter Bell later on in the program about reverse mortgages. We certainly have seen situations where, in order to avoid one kind of risk, market risk, clients have taken another kind of risk, which is essentially running out of assets before they run out of lifespan. So one of the reasons why people end up doing reverse mortgages is because they were not able to successfully plan how to make their income stream last throughout their retirement years.
And it's something, Kathleen, we're getting a lot more calls on, and I'm sure anybody listening to this program, you've seen all the movie stars from Fred Thompson to the Fonz get on and tell you about the wonders of a reverse mortgage. The reason people are doing that is they don't have the assets they thought they were going to have when they got ready to retire. That's number one. And number two, the yields on what they have on their existing assets are so low. As I mentioned, if you had $1 million and you stuck it in a 2-year treasury note, you'd only get $2,200 of income. You wouldn't even get $200 a month if you had $1 million. Who would have thought we would have been talking like that? 5 years ago, you would have been getting, you know, over $4,000 a month. Today, you can't even get $200 a month. So it's one of the reasons people are taking a look at their last remaining asset, which is their home and the equity in their home. They're turning it into monthly income. And that's why you're seeing all these ads for reverse mortgages. And that's going to be the topic I'm going to discuss next with Peter Bell, who's president and CEO of the National Reverse Mortgage Lenders Association. That's coming up right after this.
Wait till the sun shines through, wait till the sky is blue, and you will wait too long, he will be gone, he will be gone.
Joining me on Lifetime Income this week is Peter Bell. He's president and CEO of the National Reverse Mortgage Lenders Association. Peter, I want to talk about reverse mortgages, and I wonder if you would sort of explain the basic essence of how these things work. I'm sure a lot of our listeners see a lot of these commercials on television every night watching the evening news, but give us a little background of how they work and where did they originate from? How did they come into play?
Well, first of all, in very basic terms, a reverse mortgage is a form of a home equity loan. The major thing that's different about it is it's a home equity loan that has a deferred payment feature. In other words, a borrower is able to start drawing money down once they have the loan, take the money out all at once as a line of credit and draw it down when they need it, or take fixed monthly payments. But where it differs from other home equity loans is there's no repayment until the borrower permanently leaves the home. So they don't have to make any payments as long as they live there. So when they sell the home and move, or when they pass away, the loan becomes due and payable. Now, where it comes from is back in the 80s, there was some work done on this concept in Minnesota and Wisconsin, and some of the senior advocates that were involved there brought it to the White House Conference on Aging back then, and then ultimately to Congress, to get Congress to pass the FHA program, known as the Home Equity Conversion Mortgage Program, or the HECM program. So it's been around since 1989 or so, and there is currently about 750,000 households that have reverse mortgages.
Now, for a lot of Americans, their major asset is their home, and there was a generation, Peter, we don't see it as much on the West Coast as you do on the East Coast, where a couple gets married, they buy a home, and they stay in that home for multiple decades. The kids grow up, they move out of the house, and the parents have this asset called a house that could either be paid for, or you have substantial amounts of equity. Explain how this and how this works for individuals that are retired that are looking for additional sources of income, and especially in a low interest rate environment, because I can't watch the evening news on any channel where I'm not seeing a reverse mortgage payment by some movie star that's recommending them.
Right. Well, in your area in Southern California, it is a very competitive market, and a number of the companies that use celebrity advertising and telemarketing are active there. So I do understand that you see a lot more commercials there than perhaps people do elsewhere around the country. Nevertheless, the product is a very flexible product that is used by different households in a number of different ways. The original concept was that when seniors are in retirement and living on a fixed income, sometimes their expenses exceed that fixed income. Yet they've been sitting on all this wealth tied up in the equity in the home. So the original concept was that they could start getting some fixed monthly payments made to them to supplement their income from Social Security or any retirement programs that they had participated in. Nowadays, we see, of course, that type of use, but we also see a number of other uses. We're seeing more and more cases of people that are retiring with decent-sized mortgages, even though they're already in their 60s or 70s. Once upon a time, when people were in their 60s or 70s, they probably had a minimal amount of mortgage left, if any, debt. But nowadays, it's much more common that people have it. So we see people take the reverse mortgage to pay off their existing indebtedness, and then the money that's going out the door each month to make a mortgage payment becomes available for other uses. We see people using reverse mortgages to purchase a new home. The classic case is a couple living in a multi-story home, not having much in savings and not really being able to maintain the home, being able to trade to a home that better fits their needs with their changes as they age. So they sell the multi-story home that has had deferred maintenance and can move into a brand new home that's perhaps single-story and designed for their needs, enhancing their ability to age in place. But by buying it with a reverse mortgage, they don't have to make any monthly payments. So there's really any number of ways that people use these reverse mortgages today. And that's why it's so important for homeowners that are interested in this to find a good, reputable, knowledgeable, reliable loan officer to work with, and also to take the counseling that they're required to go to very seriously.
In terms of taking out a reverse mortgage, you said they're very flexible. There's various ways. You can take out maybe a lump sum. You can take it in the form of payments. What are the things that individuals should be asking and looking for if they're considering this option as part of their retirement plan?
Right. Very good question, Jim. The first thing is to figure out what's the reason for needing the cash. You know, a lot of people may take out a home equity loan just to have access to money without really knowing a specific purpose. But at the retirement stages in life, the tool is probably best utilized by someone who has an idea of how they want to use it, whether it's to enhance their monthly cash flow, to make improvements or repairs to the home. Sometimes it's to do some remodeling of the home to make it safe and comfortable for aging in place. Sometimes it's to help family members. But it's good to have a sense of what the intended use is, as well as what resources they have available otherwise, because while you don't have any mortgage payments to make, the homeowner, of course, still has to pay their taxes and still has to keep the property maintained and keep it insured. So it's important that people looking at this product understand that and either take the money as a line of credit so they have reserves available for those uses, or that they think ahead and figure out how they'll pay those property charges as time goes on.
Now, I know that just from watching the commercials here that I see on the evening news, there are so many different companies that are offering these kind of reverse mortgages. Is there anything that distinguishes one company from another that makes one company more advantageous? Are there commonalities, or is it like just a simple commodity where it's just a matter of pricing?
No, there's a bit more complexity to it than simply pricing. First of all, we recommend that people work with companies that are members of our association, first and foremost, because members of our organization have committed their companies to a code of ethics and professional responsibility, which will govern their behavior and how they will treat the client. And also, then our association and our ethics committee is there as a backstop should there be any questions about the way the company has performed. So we strongly urge people to work with members of the National Reverse Mortgage Lenders Association, and individuals looking for reverse mortgage lenders to work with can find a state-by-state list of our members on our website at reversemortgage.org. So that's one part of the answer. The other is that at the moment, the market is almost exclusively the FHA product. And with the FHA product, the terms and conditions are going to be more or less the same to the lender, although there's always a possible trade-off for upfront fees versus ongoing interest rate on them. And typically, a lender will present a couple of different options to the borrower, and then the borrower needs to make a decision. Fortunately, in this case, they're not just left on their own to make that decision. They have the opportunity and, in fact, the requirement to go meet with an independent third-party reverse mortgage counselor who could help them assess their needs and look at the various offers they've been given by lenders that they've spoken to.
Peter, I've seen in some of these commercials on television, they have a DVD that a potential reverse mortgage individual can take a look that explains the product, all the things that you would want to look at. Is there one that your organization puts out that's sort of independent from the ones that come directly from the companies offering the product? In other words, is there a source of information that you can go to get to that our listeners could find out that explains how it works, the kind of things, the questions they should be asking, and the things they should be looking for?
Yes, we have a very good informational tool designed for consumers. It's not a DVD, so the consumer is going to have to sit and do some reading as opposed to watching a video. But reversemortgage.org is our consumer website, and it's the most comprehensive explanation of reverse mortgages, what they are, how they work, that you'll find anywhere. It presents the information in a number of different formats. There's a part of the website that's called the Roadmap to a Reverse Mortgage that explains the process from A to Z, step by step, every inch along the way, from first gathering information to exploring different options, selecting a lender, selecting the type of loan, how they want the payments, explaining the counseling process. Besides the roadmap, the same information is presented in a frequently asked questions format, so you can just follow the Q&A on there. And it's also on there in the form of a glossary of key terms. Like any business, reverse mortgage has its own lingo, and sometimes the terminology confuses people, so we have them there as a glossary. So between looking at the information presented in those three formats, the roadmap, the glossary, and the frequently asked questions, that's about as comprehensive a background as somebody could get. There also are good websites from National Council on Aging at ncoa.org and also at AARP that have some additional technical information. But reversemortgage.org was designed to be a one-stop source for comprehensive information about how reverse mortgages work in a non-sales presentation.
You know, you mentioned that it used to be when an individual retired, he probably had his house paid for, didn't have the amount of debt. But one thing that we've seen over the last couple decades is consumers take on a lot of debt. A lot of it sometimes may be medical related. Some of it may be related to putting kids through college. Things are more expensive today. Do you think a lot of this is behind why we're seeing individuals that have a lot more debt when they do get to retirement on their homes?
Oh, yes. There's no question about it. We use debt differently than our parents' generation did. In fact, I'm 60 years old, and I'm just about to close on a new 30-year forward mortgage. So when I do retire at some point, 8 years or 10 years down the road, I will still have a significant balance on that 30-year mortgage. So I may find, like many folks in that situation today, that it makes sense for me to get rid of that remaining balance at that point and not have to make those monthly payments. So, yeah, it's a change in attitudes that people do use debt a lot more. So we find people that have taken out 30-year mortgages or 20-year mortgages when they're in their 50s and 60s, people that have taken home equity lines in addition to their mortgages. So people are finding that as they enter retirement, they do have much more debt than historically might have been the case.
We hear a lot of stories that there's a lot of abuse in this area. Peter, if there is abuse, what kind of abuse is it?
Right.
Is there commonalities in these complaints? Fill us in a little bit.
You see a lot of stories, but you don't see a lot of different stories. You see a handful of incidents that, because of the nature of the topic and the population that's affected, get repeated over and over again. Most of the problems we see are not in the origination process, not in the lending process, but more where somebody has access to all of this money all of a sudden. And, you know, as the old song goes, when you have lots of money, you have lots of friends hanging around your door. And what we're finding is that people that get these sometimes find that family members come to them for assistance that they might not have otherwise. Just saw a report that there are a number of instances that have been reported recently of caregivers that are helping seniors out, actually drawing the money out of their reverse mortgage and keeping it for themselves. We've seen instances of a caregiver convincing the person they're taking care of to give them power of attorney and then the caregiver going out and getting them. So what's important is to understand how they work, and you got to manage it just like anything else. If a senior homeowner has one of these and is beginning to experience some cognitive impairment, which does happen, it's helpful if they have a family member or some other trusted advisor they could turn to and have them involved so that they could help avoid any situations where somebody inappropriately bilked them of their money. That problem is the same. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's money in the bank or cashing in CDs or taking the funds from a reverse mortgage. It's just the challenge of somebody that has changing condition and having them being able to protect their money.
Would you say that, you know, the press sometimes will take a story and they'll blow it up? So as you mentioned, you don't think there's a lot of instances of this occurring, but when they do occur, they gather attention and the media focuses a lot about it. And so therefore, it's given the impression that there's a lot of abuse in this area. Is that your impression?
Yes. It's not my impression. It's the fact. We poll all of the state attorneys general offices on a periodic basis, and the departments of banks, the bank supervisors, and they all report extremely few incidents of problems in the reverse mortgage process. The problems that they're seeing, as I say, come after the fact when people have access to the money, and then somebody disreputable comes along and tries to sell them something. Sometimes it's remodeling, sometimes it's roof repairs, and ends up bilking them out of their money that way. So it's the same scams that seniors face when they have money, but it's not reverse mortgage per se. The other place that you see headlines is you see stories of homeowners that have taken reverse mortgages and then down the road can't pay their property taxes, and they face issues because of that. Now, in some of the press, it's reported as a reverse mortgage problem, but the truth of the matter is even if you have no mortgage whatsoever, if you can't pay your property taxes, you face the possibility of a tax foreclosure. So the situation is the same with the reverse mortgage or not. And in fact, in the reverse mortgage case, if you don't pay your taxes, the loan servicer is required to advance funds on your behalf and then to work with you to try and help you get some counseling and get on a plan to be able to repay them. So there's actually an additional safeguard involved in the cases of reverse mortgage borrowers who find that they're having a hard time meeting their obligations to pay tax.
So if we were to sum up one of the most important things, and you know, your story about when all of a sudden you get a lump sum payment, sometimes when you get that money, it's kind of like, gosh, I'd love to buy a new car. I'd like to buy a new boat. I'd like to do some stuff. And people do foolish things. It's no different than some of the tragedies we hear about people that suddenly don't have anything and they win the lottery. They become the most popular person in the neighborhood and their family. And a couple of years later, they end up being dead broke.
Right. So to be honest with you, we don't see a lot of cases of people doing things like buying boats or recreational vehicles. For the most part, we see people using the reverse mortgages to pay off existing debt. The reverse mortgage has to be the first lien on the property, so any indebtedness that's secured by the property has to be paid off with loan proceeds as part of the closing. And then oftentimes we find people have other consumer debt, perhaps from healthcare expenses, perhaps from other reasons, so they want to get rid of that so they could stop seeing that monthly outflow of cash to make payments. And after paying off debts, we see people essentially setting it up as either a rainy day fund, a line of credit that they could draw down when they need, or to have fixed monthly payments that are matched to what their monthly expenses are to cover the shortfall that they're experiencing prior to getting the reverse mortgage.
So if you were to boil it down to a sequence of steps that an individual should begin their due diligence process, define those steps for our listeners, if you would.
Yeah, very good question, Jim. I would start by doing research. The companies that advertise on television and send the DVDs out, I think that's a good first step to order one and look at the DVD. I think having that kind of explanation before you start reading would be useful. I would not stop the information gathering there. I would then go to our website and perhaps others that are out there, or there are books. There is the Four Dummies series. There's Reverse Mortgages for Dummies. There's any number of books that are there. You can find them on Amazon or any of the other booksellers like that. So I would suggest looking at the website, watching the video first, looking at the website, perhaps looking at books, and get some information, and then begin to talk to lenders and talk to a couple of different lenders in your area to get different opinions on what product they think best serves the needs. And it's important that the prospective borrower be candid with their loan officer about what they feel their need for cash is. Because generally, people don't wake up in the morning and say, oh, I think I'll go get a reverse mortgage. Generally, it's a response to some issue that they're facing in their life. Either they can't make ends meet, or they have some health care bills that are mounting, or they want to help their grandchildren buy books when they go back to school in the fall. So there's generally some underlying reason, and it's good to be candid about that with both the loan officer and also with the counselor that you go to. So you start with learning either through the video or the websites and reading, and then talk to loan offices. And then if somebody is interested in proceeding, before the lender can actually formally process an application, the prospective borrower needs to go out for a counseling session with an independent counseling agency, and the counselors all work for nonprofit counseling organizations that are HUD approved, and each of the individual counselors has to be exam qualified. They have to take a test. They have to participate in continuing education. So they're a great resource out there. There is often a fee of approximately $125 the counseling session, although for those seniors who are restricted in their incomes, a lot of the agencies will waive that fee. And the counseling is a great time to both talk about the prospective borrower's own needs and concerns, as well as to get a check on what they're being told by the lenders that they're talking to. And I think once you do those four things, talk to a couple of loan offices and then go talk to a counselor, I think at that point a prospective borrower should be in a pretty good position to make a responsible decision as to whether this is appropriate for them.
Peter, is there a situation where, let's say, there was a need for some short-term funds, there was emergency, let's say, a medical, home repairs, or, you know, maybe the car broke down and you had to get a new car, and then all of a sudden, through either investments or going back to work or doing something, you want to reverse that situation? How complicated is it to get out of that reverse mortgage? In other words, let's just take an illustration. Let's say there was a medical emergency, had to come up with $20,000 or $30,000. You take out a reverse mortgage, you have the $30,000, but let's say the couple between them go back to work or work part-time and they want to pay down that reverse mortgage and get the mortgage or the lien on the house removed completely. How difficult is that process?
Well, it's not difficult. Now, a few things there. Reverse mortgages come in both open-ended and closed-ended varieties. What that means is on a closed-ended loan, you get all the money up front, the full amount that's available to you. And you draw it down up front. You could pay it back at any time, or you could pay it back partially at any time so that less interest is accruing or interest accruing on a small amount. But you cannot draw it down again on a closed-end. A fixed-rate reverse mortgage will be a closed-end loan. The loans that were more common until a couple of years ago when the fixed rates appeared are variable-rate loans, and they're still out there in the marketplace. And they are open-end, which means that you have the amount of money available to you. You could draw it down. You could pay back any amount of it. And that amount goes back into the line of credit, so it's available again to be drawn down at a later date. So once again, this is why I stated up front, it's important to think about what the needs are, what the anticipated use is, to determine whether the fixed rate closed end or the variable rate open end best serves somebody's needs. There's a tendency among folks to want to opt for the fixed rate. And I understand why that's the case based on our experience with regular mortgages. But in a reverse mortgage situation, to many people, the open-ended line of credit is really the most valuable option for them.
As we close, first of all, give out your website because you have a wealth of information. That seems to me to be the first obvious place that our listeners would want to go to if they're considering a reverse mortgage. Let's talk about your site. One, two, three steps. I'm in that situation. I have a house. I have equity. I've got a financial emergency, no matter where it's coming from, medical or otherwise. Step one, two, three, if you could.
Okay, step one, visit www.reversemortgage.org and read through that. And after reading through it, there is a state-by-state list of lenders on there. So I would suggest if you don't know lenders that offer this product to take a look at that list and pick a few of them and call them and talk to them and see what kind of product they would offer. Some of the companies do origination entirely over the telephone, some over the internet. Some have loan offices that will come to the house. So I think a prospective borrower needs to decide whether they're comfortable doing the transaction remotely via telephone and internet or whether they want to sit down with somebody face-to-face. You know, we all have our preferences for that. So talk to a couple lenders, get proposals from them, and then after considering all that, then I would suggest contacting the lenders. Will each provide a list of counseling agencies. And then it's up to the borrower to schedule an appointment for the counseling. The counseling can be done face-to-face by going to the counselor, or it can be done over the telephone. And once again, that depends on the preference of the individual borrower. So take it from the top, then look at the website, ours and others, talk to a couple of lenders, and then follow up with a counselor.
Peter, once again, I'd like to thank you for joining us on Lifetime Income. And once again, close with your website, because I think that's stop number one in the process if they're considering it.
Well, we're very proud of it, so I'm glad to plug it yet one more time. It is www.reversemortgage.org.
We've been speaking with Peter Bell. He's president and CEO of the National Reverse Mortgage Lenders Association. And once again, if you find yourself in need of funds and you are considering a reverse mortgage, make Peter's website stop number one in your process of doing your own due diligence. Peter, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thank you for covering this topic, Jim. I very much appreciate it.
Well, Jim, that was an interesting interview with Peter Bell. But as you mentioned on your weekend show, time is running out for income investors, which is why sometimes they'll have to resort to these reverse mortgage situations.
Well, Kathleen, unfortunately, that's the world that we live in. Governments are running up and racking up major deficits, which means their interest costs are going up. So their central banks are artificially suppressing interest rates, which is the world we live in today. That's why if you're investing in 3-month T-bills, you can't even earn 0.1%. You would have to go out 1 year to earn 0.1% and 2 years to earn 0.2%. But nonetheless, It's the world we're living in. And as investors worldwide scramble for yields, I'm sure these yields are likely to go lower because central banks are still cutting interest rates, as we've seen here in the last 2 weeks with major central banks. So I'm sure this story is probably going to get worse before it gets better. On behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, Jim Poplava, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.